John Albert is a perinatologist in private practice in Charlotte, North Carolina. I think he's familiar to many of us on the call. He's also the current president of the NC OBGYN Society, who just had their annual meeting this past weekend. So I really appreciate his time because this is a very busy stretch that he is in right now. Dr. Albert's also a clinical professor at Wake Forest University School of Medicine. And most important, he's a member of the expert panel for the 39 Weeks Project. So he's been contributing behind the scenes since Nancy Cheshire started putting this project together over a year ago. One thing, and I think he'll talk about this more specifically, Dr. Albert was instrumental in helping to put all of those many indications into the categories which I just showed a minute ago. And teams received those categories as part of their quarterly reports. Today I'm asking him to lend us some expertise about some of the questions that keep coming up, like the gray areas or these soft call indications for delivering before 39 weeks. And he's also going to address some of the questions about gestational age dating criteria, and that is a theme that we are going to come back to throughout the presentations this morning.
Well, let's just start with the fact that obviously this is a very important problem nationwide, particularly in North Carolina, and I've really noticed it before when I was working with residents. We never induced for any social reasons, we always heard on the private side, we called it, that there was a problem with inductions. And I would talk to physicians and I would say, hey, listen, what's the issue here? And they said, listen, if I had somebody to tell me that I can't do these inductions, I would love it. But I have patients coming to me saying, you know, if you don't deliver me at this particular date, I'm going to find an obstetrician who will. And it's a competitive market here, and so that was a big, big issue. And so what we did here was just said we played the bad guy. And for an obstetrician to schedule a patient for electively or just schedule anybody without a clear indication, they had to get approval from a perinatologist. And that just gave the physicians an out. They just said, listen, I have no control. I can't do it. And that's really helped out. But that didn't mean right off the bat we were getting a lot of calls for quasi-indications like this patient's a real good friend of mine, and I think the baby's a little bit big. And so we would say you have to have an amniocentesis. And that was enough of a disincentive for people not to do it. Anyway, okay, now I'm getting somewhere here. I'm going to pull up my documents. And,
we can keep stalling if we need to. Just a reminder.
Go ahead.
Sorry, there's somebody with feedback on their line. If you would just mute your phone, please.
I'm going to pull up my presentation off my computer. So if you'll go to slide number two, there is the big trial that was done by the MFM network that gives us a lot of our information. Says that what the data was that the risk of RDS at 37 weeks was 3.7% compared to 0.9% with 39 weeks and 1.9% or nearly 2%. And what that came out to be, when you looked at the respiratory morbidity, transient tachypnea of the newborn, RDS, there was a five-fold increase in cost for delivering someone at 37 weeks compared to waiting until 39 weeks, and a four-fold increase at 38 weeks. And this holds true even if the induction is at 38 and four-sevenths to 38 and six-sevenths weeks compared to deliveries that are delayed until 39 weeks. And for every 100 deliveries, the cost savings, this is just the cost, not the charges, just the cost savings to the hospital or the system for waiting waiting until 39 weeks to do the induction is $160,000 at 37 weeks and $50,000 at 38 weeks. Now, the next slide, they have asked me to kind of address confirming the gestational age. And for a lot of you, you're very fortunate. You get first trimester ultrasounds. Those are great. You have sure last menstrual periods, which are good. But what we need to have to be absolutely positive that we have an accurate gestational age is you need to have an ultrasound prior to 20 weeks. And this is by ACOG. Less than 20 weeks gestation before an induction can be done at 39 weeks for elective indications or a repeat cesarean section. If you don't have that, then you must have a confirmed Doppler auscultation of the fetal heart rate for 30 weeks, or it has to be at least 36 weeks from a positive serum or urine pregnancy test. And so if it's someone who presents late, you can't get that ultrasound to go along with the last menstrual period, then you're going to have to do an amniocentesis to confirm lung maturity. Now, what are some of the absolute indications for induction of labor? Obviously, bleeding, abruptio placenta. There's different ways to diagnose that, but a lot of people have a spotting when they're coming into labor and delivery for cervical change. But clearly, if there's evidence of abruption, that's an indication. Chorioamnionitis, clinical signs, obviously, urine tenderness with fever, high elevated white cell count, fetal tachycardia, maternal tachycardia. You can do an amniocentesis to confirm. Now, gestational hypertension, I'll have a slide to deal with that, and preeclampsia. Maternal indications such as diabetes, and then there's fetal compromise. Such as an example of that would be isoimmunization to anti-D, E, C, et cetera, growth restriction, and oligohydramnios. Now, our next slide. What is truly IUGR? Now, you hear the term less than the 10th percentile. That is the definition for small for gestational age. If I ask a resident, you know, would give me what percentage of people are small for gestational age, the answer, of course, is just 10%. And the vast majority, 70-80%, are perfectly normal. They're just small, genetically going to be small babies. What we need to evaluate is, is the baby small for some other reason? It's not going to reach its growth potential. Is the placenta not working well? Is there an abnormal karyotype? Is there some type of an anomaly like gastroschisis associated with the low weight or a skeletal dysplasia? But it's very important to differentiate the two, because if you're a term 37 weeks and you have evidence of growth restriction, then absolutely you need to be delivered. If there's severe compromise, you deliver it before then. But just because a fetus is below the 10th percentile on ultrasound does not mean someone has to be delivered. Now, I can't really argue with somebody for inducing someone at 37, 38 weeks for a baby below the 10th percentile. But if they have normal fluid, if they have normal Doppler, if they have a reactive NST, and the cervix is not favorable, then delaying delivery is extremely reasonable. And so I think that when people induce for a baby being small, it really needs to be clarified that there is placental dysfunction, if at all possible. The other, and I'll be glad to answer any questions on these, but the other, what I've been asked about is oligohydramnios, and so these are this slide here, this next slide, slide number six is sort of just talking about placental dysfunction in IUGR. That it's helpful to make that confirmation if you have oligohydramnios, because that means there's less urine output by the baby. Doppler of the umbilical artery is greater than 95th percentile. Documentation of poor fetal growth over a three-week interval. So if somebody shows a lack of growth over 1 week, that's not good enough. But if there's been 3 weeks and they've got normal fluid, normal Doppler, but over a three-week period, there's not been a very adequate growth of the fetus, it's sort of arrested, that's a good indication. And I pay most attention to the abdominal circumference. The abdominal circumference should increase by at least a half a centimeter a week at that gestational age. And, of course, it's always good to confirm the placental function, non-stress test, CST, or biophysical profile. So all those need to be reassuring if you are below the 10th percentile. Hypertension. Next slide. Hypertension. There's been debate on whether people at 37, 38 weeks or 36 weeks, if they have an elevated blood pressure, when do you deliver them? And I think there's two types of hypertension. There's chronic hypertension or gestational hypertension without proteinuria, and then there's preeclampsia. The difference between the two is, do you have more than 300 milligrams of protein on a 24-hour urine sample or 2-plus proteinuria on a spot check? But ultimately, it really doesn't matter. If you have there's a recent study done in The Lancet in 2009 that if you have a patient 37 or 38 weeks and everything else is good, but the diastolic blood pressure is greater than in their study for chronic hypertension or gestational hypertension greater than 95, or they use 90 for preeclampsia, that's for proteinuria, that the patients, if they were induced at 37, 38 weeks, did better than those that you waited until 39 weeks. And they needed fewer antihypertensive agents given intravenously, such as presaline or labetalol, and fewer anticonvulsants, which is going to be your mag sulfate. And so, clearly, if you have blood pressures in this range, and I would say those two blood diastolic blood pressures greater than 6 hours apart at rest, then you have an indication for delivery. Otherwise, then delivery can be delayed until 39 weeks. And the other benefit, of course, was the lower C-section rate in prima gravidis, who had the induction at 37 weeks. And that's because the disease, if you wait too long, the disease gets more severe, and there gives a sense of urgency to it. So the next slide is the oligohydramnios. How do you define that? Well, nobody's really come up with a good definition, and there's no specific one that anybody's going to be held true to. However, the only way to estimate amniotic fluid volume is with ultrasound. And the two numbers that you'll see out there is an amniotic fluid index of less than 5 centimeters. So you measure all four quadrants, and measure the deepest pocket that is cord-free. I don't really use that. I mean, I can subjectively look at an ultrasound and say that fluid looks low. What I use is the criteria that we use on our biophysical profile is, do I have a deepest vertical pocket of less than 2 centimeters? And if I do, then I consider that a true oligohydramnios. And delivery, really, just for straight-out oligohydramnios, should not be considered until they're at least 37 weeks gestational age. But if they're 37 weeks and you have a deepest pocket of less than 37 centimeters, it's reasonable to induce labor, particularly if you have a favorable cervix. Reasons why you may not induce if you have an unfavorable cervix is if you have a great biophysical profile, make a normal reactive non-stress test in association with that without variable decelerations, and no evidence of growth restriction. You're not obligated to deliver. You can wait until 39 weeks. But I think that there's enough controversy involved that you can wait until 37 weeks, but you should not deliver these folks at 34, 35, or 36 weeks just because of oligohydramnios. That is not appropriate. But at 37 or 38 weeks, if they have a deepest pocket less than 2 centimeters, I do think it is reasonable, but that should be your criteria. One other point I would like to make is, What is the commitment to induction? There's a lot of people were taught, once you make the decision to induce or deliver someone, that patient cannot leave labor and delivery until that baby's out of the uterus. And that is not true. If you induce somebody, for whatever reason, whether it's because of the hypertension or some other reason, and the patient just does not respond, the contractions are not adequate, the cervix isn't changing, you can do this for 1 or 2 days, but then you don't have to throw in the towel and just do a C-section. It is very reasonable to send this patient home because you've got usually a great oxytocin challenge test. Negative, no decelerations with a reactive strip. Then this patient can easily go home for 2 or 3 days and come back and try again. I see that too often where after 2 days of induction, well, that's it. It's not going to deliver, and we're just going to do a C-section. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why C-section rate is so high in these patients who are induced. They're just not ready. So you have just the best test available to evaluate how that placenta is functioning with that prolonged oxytocin test. Now, I put this slide in here. It was what Ms. Marion has already reviewed with you, the different criteria for people use for induction. So look at that and see if there's anything on there that you have a question about. You know, is like polyhydramnios, is that a reason to deliver early? And the answer is no. Macrosomia, no, not necessarily. Not without a mature amniocentesis. Other indications that sort of come up, cholestasis of pregnancy. If you have confirmed cholestasis, which to me a lot of times ends up being just pruritus, and, just constipation without any other obvious cause, is generally cholestasis, but you check obviously a fasting bile acids. But those patients, we do an amniocentesis on to confirm lung maturity at 36 or 37 weeks, but I deliver them no later than 38 weeks. Lupus, if we have good growth and they're doing well, no reason to deliver them before 39 weeks. Diabetes, if it's good, reasonable control, there is no reason to deliver them before 39 weeks. Some patients are non-compliant. They continue to have persistent elevated blood sugars, and I hate to sort of give them the prize of an early delivery for poor compliance, but sometimes that's what you have to do in the best case of the infant. But there are type 1 diabetics that are very brittle, very difficult to control, and we will do an amniocentesis and deliver them early. But often they'll develop other indications like hypertension. Previous classical cesarean section or myotomy for fibroids or myomectomies. We do amniocentesis on those folks at 37 weeks and do the cesarean at 37 weeks if it's mature because of the increased risk of rupture of the uterus prior to the onset of labor. Prior C-section, just they need to wait till 39 weeks. Placenta previa. Again, we generally do an amniocentesis at 36 weeks to consider delivery. Vasoprevia, you'll start to see more diagnosis of vasoprevia as we notice filamentous cord insertions on the 18 to 20 week ultrasound. And for those, we're delivering at 37 weeks, 36 weeks or earlier if there's preterm labor. Maternal drug use. Someone obviously is showing up into your unit and she's got cocaine on board and she's 36, 37 weeks and you have to call. It's reasonable to do an amniocentesis to document lung maturity and get that baby out before she has an abruption. And obviously HIV, if someone's HIV positive, they get delivered at 38 weeks. They get delivered at 38 weeks without an amniocentesis because we don't want to transfer the virus to the fetus. So with that, I am glad to answer any questions or we can move on to the next talk.
Thanks so much, Dr. Albert. I will say Nancy Cheshire has joined us from Botswana. So good morning, good afternoon, Nancy, and thanks for being with us. And she has already submitted a question. I think it's your line. We have a bunch of feedback with Dr. Albert. But Nancy's question was, what would you do with maternal drug use with a situation like marijuana where it's not a vasoactive drug?
Marijuana, no, that is not, I consider that like nicotine. It's even less harmful, I think, than nicotine. So someone who smokes cigarettes, they still have to wait till 39 weeks. And this primarily is cocaine. That's the one I'm worried about. And still, I think you need to have a mature amnio.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? And again, just to keep things simple with the lines, please use the chat window at the bottom of your screen, bottom left corner. I do have two comments I was going to make. The hypertension study from 2009 that Dr. Albert mentioned is on the extranet for teams in the project who want to access that article that is posted. Okay, from Women's in Greensboro, Dr. Kaplan would like to ask, if the amnio is immature, how long do you wait?
Well, I think that that is you have to wait at least a week. And I have to admit that if it is close, I mean, if you use a cutoff of 55 for your SA, or if you use lamellar bodies, if it's real close, and usually we're doing these amnios at obviously 38 weeks, and so if you wait a week, you're 39 weeks, and they just go ahead and just get delivered because they're 39 weeks. If you're 37 weeks, we'll often repeat the amniocentesis at 38 weeks to, but unless it was real close, if it was 52 or 50, or whatever your lab is using for their lung maturity, after a week, I don't necessarily repeat the amniocentesis. But you know, usually we've got some type of a clinical indication. It's not a purely elective delivery. And those amnios for purely elective deliveries have gone down dramatically over the past year for us, as doctors are not pushing that as often. What they're doing is they're telling patients almost like right off the bat in their first exam is, you know, we do not deliver before 39 weeks, and there's not any debate about that. The hospital won't let us. And with that sort of pre-education of the patients, then it's very few patients that push for that elective delivery for the amnio.
Great. We'll take one more question just in the interest of time. But again, if people have further questions, please do use the chat window or send them by email to us at Picnic. Dr. Albert is very generous with us, and I'm sure he will follow up with any questions that come up. Carla Damas at March of Dimes has a question. Do antenatal steroids affect the amnio results for fetal lung maturity?
Does steroids do?
Right.
You know, I know, maybe someone else has an answer to this, Nancy particularly. But in Australia right now, they are doing a study evaluating at term, just giving patients betamethasone prior to inducing them in labor, even at term. I'm not aware. I've not been able to find good evidence that an amniocentesis. They do an amniocentesis, and then you do your corticosteroids injection, and then you repeat the amniocentesis. How much steroids improve that? But clearly, the ACOG criteria says you do not give betamethasone after 34 weeks unless you have confirmed lung, or you've been unable to confirm lung maturity with an amniocentesis. So if I have an immature amnio, I really want to get the patient delivered, I will sometimes give betamethasone, wait 48 hours, and then deliver them. But that's probably happened twice in the last 3 years, and I've got some clinical reason to push towards that. So I don't think that data is available to say that the betamethasone improves the results of the amniocentesis, but I do believe it does reduce the risk of RDA in these term infants that would have had it.
Great. And Nancy also just wrote in from Botswana to say this very similar, that just to give them wait 48 hours, and then there's no reason to repeat the amnio. I'm going to wrap up the questions just to keep us moving in the interest of time.
One question.
Sorry, go ahead.
This is Marty. This is Marty McCabe. I'm on the phone, kid. I'm sorry, so I don't have access to the chat. I'm the director for Picnic. And, John, I just want to thank you. You guys have been a real tip-of-the-spear group in terms of us pursuing this project. And I have a quick question. What have you seen as results out at your place? You've been fairly aggressive about trying to pursue reduction in these deliveries. And have you seen any downside with sort of the pretty strict criteria that you put in place for not doing these deliveries?
Have I seen any downside? I'm sorry. There's been a lot of little beeps that are kind of blocked out your question, but I'm assuming that the question was: is there been any downside in us putting these strict criteria in? And I have not. I mean, the first downside was I was having to deal with irate obstetricians who were used to having their way. The biggest problem for them, obviously, is they have a patient who they are very attached to and want to deliver when they're on call, and there's 38 and 5/7, and they're not going to be on call for another 5 days, and they're worried the patient's going to come in and deliver on one of their partner's nights, and that's been the biggest negative on my part, is having to play the bad guy. But we've noticed a big drop off in that we've stopped getting those phone calls. But as far as clinical care, I haven't really seen a drop in our C-section rate. I think that people are doing obviously a better job of documenting, and we think we see a lower incidence in term babies going to the neonatal intensive care unit. But we don't have good data to back that up. The neonatologists say they can tell a difference. And I think the other big problem is there's a 1 in 1,000 risk of a stillbirth prior between 37 and 39 weeks, and that's always I think the big ethical question is what's we have all this dollar amount on the frequency of these patients go to the intensive care unit, but what's the cost when you have a stillborn and someone who's 38 weeks that wanted to be delivered, and that's certainly a reasonable topic of intense debate.
Thank you so much. I'm going to keep us moving in the interest of time, just because we have so many great speakers today, but I really appreciate your contributions, Dr. Albert. I have a feeling there will be some follow-up by email from some further questions, and you may have just got yourself invited back to have a future conversation about that ethical dilemma you just raised, because that's a great parting note.
Okay.
So we may be getting back on your calendar. I'm going to ask everyone to mute again. Thank you so much for being with us this morning. If we can shift gears, since we just raised the question of the neonatologist. And I'm sorry, Dr. Albert, there's an echo in the phone, and it may be you. So if you could mute your phone,
okay.
Something between you and me here.
All right, I will hang up. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day. So we are actually going to shift gears to a neonatology perspective. We still have some echo. Again, if you are not muted, please mute your phone, particularly if you're on a cell phone. We have Dr. Hugo Navarro with us this morning. He is a neonatologist and the medical director of the special care nursery at Alamance Regional Medical Center, where he's been for the past 5 years almost now. Originally from Panama, he came to North Carolina by way of Spain and Florida. He's also an assistant professor of pediatrics at Duke. Interestingly, he's the only neonatologist who's a member of a 39-week team. And I think that it was just his perspective on perinatal quality improvement is clearly just an integral part of the team's work at the hospital, and it has since made me realize that we might have done better to bridge that gap sooner across the collaborative, but better late than never. So we're really delighted to have Dr. Navarro with us today. And he's going to talk about some of the issues in these late preterm and early term infants. These 37 and 38 week deliveries often free, or I won't say how often, I will leave that for a future presenter to address just how often they actually may be late preterm kids and have the complications of the late preterm infant. We'll hear from Dr. Kamath in Ohio later this morning specifically about that very issue. But Dr. Navarro, you should be able to forward the slides using the arrows at the top of your screen yourself. I'm going to mute just in case it's my phone. But again, everyone who is not Dr. Navarro, please mute your phone. And Dr. Navarro, if you'd like to go ahead, thank you for being with us this morning.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for the invitation. So I'm going to start with this talk saying that by learning from the late term, we can understand better the early term infants in these two groups of the lab. And sometimes it's so-called early term and being a late preterm or vice versa. Okay, which arrow are you talking about? This one? Okay, so the goal today is to increase the awareness of vulnerability in the late preterm and early term infants by discussing the definition and incidence, also the physiologic limitations on morbidity, mortality, and also sometimes for questions. So very important is the definition, because since that this has been changing in the past couple of years, so until recently we have classified infants by gestational age in pre-terms, terms, and post-terms. However, due to the difference in their physiology, development, morbidity, mortality, and long-term outcome, we are using a new terminology to describe the gestational age, which basically is preterm, the late preterm, which is between 34.07 to 36.67, well known, and more recently, the early term, which is between 37.07 weeks and 38.67 weeks, and also the post term.
Dr. Navarro, I'm going to interrupt for just a minute. I don't know if you're on speakerphone, but if you could just get a little closer to your phone or maybe just pick up the receiver, you're just a little muted.
Oh, better?
It's a little bit hard to hear you. I don't know if you're just a little bit far away from your phone or if you could just pick up and speak into the receiver. It just sounds like you're on speakerphone.
Yes, okay. Let me change it. Now, better?
Much better, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, okay, let me move to the next. So regarding the incidence of the late preterm, we can say that this group has increased from 7.3% in the 90s to 9.1% in 2005 of live births in this country. And also, this group accounts for 70% of preterms, which is 350,000 delivers a year. So this group represents the majority of the preterms. Regarding the early term, this group represents 700,000 births per year, which is 17.5% of live births that occur between 37.07 and 38.67 weeks of gestation. So between the late preterm and early term infants, we have approximately 1 million deliveries a year. So this is a very, very important group. So why? Why this is happening? Well, we really don't know why, but it seems that it's multifactorial. There seems to be an increase in the surveillance and medical interventions. There is inaccurate gestational age estimates. The presumption of fetal maturity at 34 weeks of gestation, also changes in maternal demographics and health, like obesity, diabetes, and also multiple gestations. Also, there has been an increase in the rates of elective C-sections and inductions of labor. Also, there is maternal physician concerns about complications of vaginal delivery and subtle changes in medical thresholds for C-sections, and also willingness of mothers to incur on behalf of their child. So, not all the preterms nor the terms are the same. So, this increase in late preterms and early term raises the risk for physiologically immature infants, which increase the risk for medical complications that result in higher morbidity and mortality during their hospitalization. Also, there is an increase in admissions to an ICU and duration of hospitalization, disrupting the infant-family bonding. There is also an increase in rates of readmissions during the neonatal period, and there is also an increase in the long-term complications. So, this is a story that you are familiar with by Oshiro, showing the NICU admission rate on the vertical axis. You can see that in early term and term infants with normal pregnancies by gestational age is clearly higher in infants less than 39 weeks. So there are several stories. We're going to see one more here. This is by Clark. And in this study, the admission percentage is higher compared to other studies, probably because different hospitals, also providers, and also admission criteria. And this was a prospective observational study conducted in 27 hospitals over a three-month course in 2007 among the term planned deliveries, which were purely elective, and the rest were indicated. So NICU here means any unit other than normal newborn units,
And there was some interfacility variation between units, something that I think is also going on in the Perinatal Quality Collaborative. And it's interesting that this study also shows the increase in the number of admissions. This is just to show you some of the most frequent problems that we find, and also the striking difference in morbidity between late preterms and term infants. These are the most common problems and treatments in descending order in this group of patients. So we have feeding problems, we have also respiratory distress, we have also an important group of patients that require evaluation for sepsis, that require IV fluids, that get jaundice, that get hypoglycemic, that have temperature instability, apnea, and also some of them require mechanical ventilation. So these babies can eat, can go, and some of them can't stay home. So what happens here? We have a poor feeder, and we know that lower the gestational age, worse the feeding skills, and these infants tend to get dehydrated and also to have hypoglycemia. And these two problems worsen the poor feeding skills. At the same time, dehydration is associated with hyperthermia and hyperbilirubinemia. And if you have a patient that has hyperthermia and or hyperbilirubinemia and or hypoglycemia, this patient may end getting IV fluids or antibiotics or phototherapy and ends being an admission. This is just to show you that the lung development doesn't stop at 34 weeks the way we used to think, or at 37 weeks. So the alveolar period continues for up to 8 years. And also we need to remember that the infant diabetic motor lung development is 4 weeks behind. This is just to show you that the most common respiratory problems in descending order are TTN, transitory tachypnea, RDS, and pulmonary hypertension. And also we need to keep in mind that they are more frequent in infants born via C-section. And here we can see clearly that the group under 39 weeks, the one with more incidence of RDS, is the one with more incidence of RDS. Also, infants born at 37, 38 weeks have a significantly higher risk for transitory tachypnea and pulmonary hypertension compared to infants born at 39 weeks. So studies of infants delivered by elective sections have consistently shown that the risk for respiratory distress syndrome and TTN is inversely proportional to gestational age. So this is a big problem. Here to show you that not only the respiratory problems are more common, but also the incidence of RDS is higher in the early term, and the requirement of ventilator use. This is basically what I'm showing here, that not only the incidence of RDS, but also the use of the ventilator is higher in this group of infants. Jaundice is also a common problem, and the lower the gestational age, higher the bilirubin levels, and also more prolonged the hyperbilirubinemia and length of stay. Metabolic concerns are more frequent. Lower the gestational age, higher the risk for hypoglycemia. Lower the gestational age, higher the risk for temperature instability. Also, lower the gestational age, higher the risk for apnea, which can be central, also obstructive, or mixed. This is just to show you that the normal appearance of the developing brain on MRI, and you can see on the left how smooth is the cortical surface in the micropremie compared to older infants. Also, the myelination proceeds in a progressive and predictable manner. And the take-home message here is that the rapid brain growth takes place between the last trimester to 2 years of age, and this might continue until the kid is 14 years of age. So if we interrupt this development, this brain development, we might end having consequences. And at birth, the brain mass of the late preterm is only 70% of that of term infants, and this myelination is markedly underdeveloped in the late preterm. This is just to show you the big picture of the morbidity risk, and you can see the striking difference between infants less than 39 weeks and the infants 39 and 40 weeks, and you can see that the morbidity risk is higher at lower gestational age. Also, the mortality is greater in the late preterm for each of the leading 10 causes of death. So this is very important. Also, the morbidity after discharge is clear that in the first month after discharge, these late preterms and early terms are readmitted more frequently. Also, late preterm infants not admitted to the NICU have a higher risk for readmissions. And also, we need to keep in mind that breastfed preterms are twice likely to require hospital-related care readmissions compared to breastfed infants. And there was no difference in the formula fed group. So these babies have problems with their feeding skills. Also, there are long-term infant long-term sequela of the, in this group of patients. And here we can see that in addition to an increased risk of mortality, late preterms have higher relative rates of developmental handicaps compared to term infants, specifically school performance difficulties, behavioral disabilities, specifically attention deficit disorders, which are more prevalent in late preterm infants. And such impairments may be related to an incomplete brain development after birth in this group of patients. So in summary, we can say that the late preterm and the early term infants are a greater risk for greater risk than term for acute and long-term complications. Also that the late preterm and early term groups are increasing. The causes for the increase in rates of these groups are unclear. The route and timing of delivery of this group of patients have important implications for short-term and long-term outcomes. Also, the risk and benefits for planned induction of labor or elective sections for mother and infant should be carefully considered by mothers, families, and physicians when determining the optimal timing and route of delivery. Also, our understanding of the maternal, fetal, and neonatal long-term outcomes and cause of late preterm and early-term birth is incomplete. And we can conclude saying that research is needed to increase our understanding of maternal and infant outcomes in infants born between 34 and 38 weeks gestation to determine the efficacy and safety of strategies to optimize these outcomes, and to develop interventions that affect physiologic maturation of the fetus when premature delivery is necessary or elective. And that's all, Kate.
Well,
so
thank
we are
you
open
so
for questions.
Yeah, I'll give everyone a moment if anyone wants to type in a question for Dr. Navarro. Thank you so much for sharing that information. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to hear in just a few minutes some Ohio data that talks about the accuracy of gestational age in the early term kids and how many of them actually may be late preterm infants, which makes this body of research all the more relevant to the project that we're working on. But again, I just really appreciate Dr. Navarro kind of rolling up his sleeves and jumping in with this project. His team came on a little bit late and got right involved. Immediately, Dr. Navarro had all of the right questions that we needed the neonatologist at the table up front to ask, like, what about the hypoglycemia and feeding issues in these kids? And what about hyperbilly? And how are you knowing if there are higher rates? And that's one of the reasons we really have learned the importance of having the bridge from obstetrics to neonatology. And one of the I don't see any questions coming in right now. I do want to shift gears just to keep us on schedule. We're going to hear from the Ohio Perinatal Quality Collaborative in North Carolina. I mean, in Ohio, sorry. And one of the things that they've really emphasized in their statewide collaborative is the importance of obstetricians and neonatologists working together on perinatal quality improvement, and they've brought both with them today. There is one question coming in before we let Dr. Navarro go. With the increased risk of late preterm readmits, has anybody moved towards using the late preterm wrap sheet to drive admissions to NICU to prevent the cost of the readmission? Are you with me here, Dr. Navarro?
Yes. Can you rephrase that, please?
So the question is, with this increased risk of a readmission in the late preterm population, is anyone moving toward using the late preterm WRAP, the RAP sheet, to drive admissions to the NICU up front to prevent the cost of readmission?
I really don't have the answer for that. If that's being taken, you know, in place. But this is something that we are aware, it's something that we are very concerned about, and I think it's something that, you know, we start thinking in, you know, options to prevent, you know, these readmissions. But specifically about this, you know, the wrap sheet, I'm not aware.
This is Lynn Halderman from Presbyterian in Charlotte. I'm in the NICU, and our nurse practitioners have actually, well, our Trudy Pollock, the manager of our nurse practitioners, actually does presentations, has some presentations to most of the OBs in in our facilities about the late preterm. So this has really increased awareness, I think, among our population.
Great. Thanks, Lynn. And I think we have heard, as we've started talking in more detail about this with some of the other teams in the project, that there has been some nice bridging between the pediatrics and the obstetric side. It sounds like in places where things are going well with the 39 weeks project, we have found some happy pediatricians who aren't getting called in at off hours quite as often to deal with some of these kids. So we're pleased that that is going in the right direction, and the feedback has generally been pretty good. And I think there has been, I think we have started to see a little increase in just what you described, which is having people on the neonatal side share some of what they're seeing with the folks on the OB side so that we kind of have a more complete picture. I'm going to keep us moving just because I don't want to I don't want to miss the great work that the Ohio Collaborative has to share with us this morning, and they've all been on the phone with us at 7:30, so I really appreciate everyone's patience while we've worked out our technical glitches. But thanks again to Dr. Navarro for taking time this morning. I think he's actually on the floor right now, so appreciate the help. And to all of our presenters for putting this great material together and sharing with us. And again, Dr. Navarro is sort of in the broad 39 Weeks Project family, and if people have specific questions they want to follow up with him about in the future, you can send those to us through the website, and we'll make sure to connect you. So we have from Ohio the several people from the Ohio Perinatal Quality Collaborative there, which kind of paved the way nationally for work on the 39 Weeks Project. And much as I'm really proud of the work we're doing here in North Carolina and really delighted about the level of expertise that we have among our expert panel, I think it's also important to hear from folks in other parts of the country about the kind of work that's going on this project, partly to know that we're not just doing this in isolation, and partly because there is some excellent work going on around the country around this issue of eliminating elective delivery before 39 weeks. I'm just going to give a brief introduction to the four folks from Ohio that we have with us this morning. I want them to be able to jump into their presentations. Some of you are familiar with Ronnie Christopher. She's the Quality Improvement Consultant for the Ohio Perinatal Quality Collaborative. In that role, she mentors, leads, and coaches 44 teams with a global outcome focused on reducing prematurity for the state of Ohio. And Ronnie has played a role as a coach in the CABC project, the neonatal project that we're doing here in North Carolina. So I know several of you met her last fall. Barbara Rose is also with us this morning. She's the OPQC project director based at Cincinnati Children's Hospital in the Child Policy Research Center for over 10 years. Her work focuses on health policy and clinical effectiveness. We also are very fortunate to have two of the physician experts who work with the OPQC group this morning. David McKenna is a perinatologist at Miami Valley Hospital in Dayton and a member of that leadership group for their 39 Weeks project. And Bina Kamath is a neonatologist and a research assistant professor in pediatrics at Cincinnati Children's, whose path to Ohio did include a stop in North Carolina for undergraduate studies down the road at Duke. And she is also one of the physician leaders for the 39 Weeks initiative. So I think, Ronnie, you are going to take it over from here. You should be able to direct your slides using those little arrows in the kind of top left corner.
Okay. Thanks, Kate. Thanks so much for inviting us. We really appreciate the time with all of you. And for those of you that I got to meet in the fall, thank you again for indulging us from Ohio. So this is very exciting that we have two states working on this project. And I will go through the first few slides pretty quickly since we are a little bit off time on the agenda, and I want everybody to have an opportunity to talk to Dr. McKenna before he jumps off at 9. So the Ohio Perinatal Quality Collaborative, just as you are, is looking at an obstetrics aim, just as you are, and we also have the neonatal aim. And, you know, our focus is the population of our perinatal health here in Ohio. We use the Breakthrough Series Collaborative Model from the IHI to drive our work, and we've been working on this since March 2007, and for those of you who have participated from the beginning of your project, you know that there's a lot of work that goes up front to recruit people and get excitement and momentum. We've been fortunate, I think, to have pretty consistent momentum in this project. We have a huge impact in Ohio, so 47% of all the births in Ohio have occurred in OPQC hospitals, and 64% of the preterm births have occurred in OPQC hospitals. 82% of the births for 39 weeks, preterm excluding late term, have occurred in our hospitals, and 80% of births 30 to 33 weeks occurred in OPQC hospitals and were likely influenced by our NICU project. So it's exciting to see that the work we're doing, while it seems maybe, you know, intense and small to us, really is having a huge impact on the state of Ohio. We'll share our results to show you that we have made a significant improvement for Ohio perinatal health. Some things that we've accomplished, just sharing that we've had that impact. All of the level three NICU hospitals are part of our project, and because we are able to look at obstetrics and neonatal care together, that helps get dialogue going. I think I'll echo what you have said, Kate, already, that we would love to improve on that going forward even, that we want to see more and more collaboration between OB and NEO so that these outcomes can be shared across all the people who impact perinatal health in Ohio. I'll let Barb talk a little bit later about some of the national attention that we've gotten about this work, and I think that one of the things that is really exciting about the possibility of sharing our work between states and why I've given you a list of our NICU and our OB participants, which you can access as much as you need to, in areas where you have very high competitive markets, there's an opportunity, because we also have that issue here in Ohio, that perhaps we can link an Ohio hospital with a similar population or size or an academic institution to somebody in North Carolina and get some great collaboration going there where you can maybe feel more free to talk and have a greater sense of transparency. So I think we shouldn't overlook that opportunity as we continue to collaborate as states. So one of the ways that we've worked toward getting our goals met, and we have nearly met the OB goal here, we are just so excited about how far we've come, because as you all know, this is a hard topic, looking at this induction issue. We use this document that you see now on your screen called the Key Driver to literally drive our work. So you read the driver from left to right, and the small box on your left is our project aim, which was to reduce by 60% the number of women in Ohio between 36.1 and 38.6 weeks of gestation for whom initiation of labor or C-section was done in absence of appropriate medical care, just the same as what you're doing. We identified that in the middle column, the main things that would drive this work were some of the things that we had to focus on, and we used this document as a way to keep us on focus, keep us tracked, on track, make sure that we have the right interventions, and it's a living document. So as we learn that something works better today than we thought it would in September, we update this document, and teams can use it to set agendas. They can use it to figure out where they want to focus their work next. We talk from it every month. And so I'll let Dr. McKenna maybe talk a little bit now about some of the things he's done at Miami Valley or some of the things he's done at OPQC using this key driver. So Dr. McKenna, I'll advance the slides for you, Dave, if you let me know.
Okay. Thanks, Ronnie. I hope everybody can hear me clearly. It certainly is an honor to address the group there in North Carolina. And I really did enjoy listening to Dr. Albert. He certainly is sharing in some of the same challenges that we face here in Ohio. So starting with the key driver diagram, what we implemented at our hospital is primarily the awareness portion, the dating criteria, and also the buy-in from the patients. Our hospital delivers about 5,000 babies a year, and that's split about 50-50 between private and resident deliveries. And achieving our project goal was absolutely no problem with the residents, as was also Dr. Albert's experience. They didn't do elective deliveries before 39 weeks and really don't do any elective deliveries at all. The privates was the biggest challenge, and they had the same issue with patients wanting to be delivered, also issues surrounding physicians wanting to deliver their particular private patients. And so we instituted a educational sheet, which we borrowed from, I believe it was from Utah that had put that together, University of Utah, and we had modified it for our use, and this is where our collaboration came in with the neonatologists. They added some particular things for our hospital. One of the, you know, certainly the issue about the increased risk for respiratory complications in these 36 to 38-week deliveries was large, but also the inability to successfully breastfeed or continue breastfeeding also has a, I think it's an important factor for patients. And when they see things like that, I think it may actually hit home a little more than this kind of nebulous thing that your baby may end up having trouble breathing. So this was a patient education sheet that we provided to all of the private physicians in English and also in Spanish. And it's a two-page form which just basically says if your doctor is, you know, recommending a delivery less than 39 weeks, these are the potential things that need to be considered. And, you know, certainly if there was an indication for delivery less than 39 weeks, we weren't trying to hold those back, but we were, again, targeting the deliveries that had no standard obstetrical indication. Along with that, another big issue was establishing accurate dating, and we were seeing a lot of inappropriate things being done. For example, patients having their estimated date of delivery changed by a third trimester ultrasound, and it seemed like sometimes that was being done for convenience sake. So we have worked very hard on making sure that patients that get admitted to labor and delivery have dating criteria per the ACOG criteria that came out in, I believe, 2009, so that it was sound dating criteria. And then finally, we have a scheduled delivery form. And many hospitals in Ohio chose to make that mandatory. We chose not to make that mandatory initially. We may be changing that further down the road, but at this point it's still voluntary. And that is a form which the physician can fill out if they're doing an induction of labor at any gestational age. And it requires them to put down the indication for delivery, the gestational dating criteria, the Bishop score, and then if it's less than 39 weeks, there's an informed consent portion for the patient to sign. And the patient also, as part of that, it says the patient has received the education sheet and understands it. And we're using that right now as a voluntary form, but through our peer review process, if physicians are having elective deliveries less than 39 weeks, and then we are requiring those individual physicians to have to use the form. So I think where we're moving at this point is that we're going to soon require all physicians to use it. And so that's pretty much how we implemented the key driver form at our hospital. And the last thing I want to say about the key driver, the key drivers, is that I found it invaluable to work with my colleagues around the state and find out what they were doing at their hospitals. And it also carries a lot of weight when I have a physician say to me, well, I'm just going to go someplace else and deliver, you know, this lady at 38 weeks if I can't do it here, when I can come back and say, well, look, this is what's going on across the state. All the hospitals are doing this, and so you're going to run out of places that you can do that at. Okay, so this is the OPQC data. So this is not the entire state of Ohio. This is just within our collaborative, which is about 50% deliveries. On the left-hand side of the form, on the left-hand side of the graph, the date is about August of 2008 when we started our initiative and data collection. So our baseline rate was about 25% at that point of scheduled deliveries, 36 to 38 weeks without an indication. And you can see over time that has dramatically decreased, and we're down at around 5% or below at this point. This is probably my favorite graph, which shows really what we've accomplished. The top line are term deliveries, and the bottom line are the 36 to 38 deliveries. And if our initiative is effective, we would expect that the deliveries that were being conducted between 36 and 38 weeks electively would shift to full term, and you would see a divergence of these lines. And right around August of 2008, you can see that where that divergence begins. And so we're shifting deliveries that were being conducted, were happening electively to from 36, 38 weeks to full term now. And by the most recent count, we've actually shifted about 1,000 deliveries. And we think that's a good achievement for our initiative. This is the birth certificate data. The first chart that you saw was just from the OPQC hospitals. And what we're hoping is that by, you know, kind of setting the standard in the state, that we're going to affect the other 50% of the hospitals in the state that are not part of OPQC. And we were seeing from the birth certificate data that the elective deliveries without an indication at 36 to 38 weeks was running right around 12%. And so our project's goal was to reduce that number by 50% down to 6%. And you can see that we're very close to achieving that goal also. And then finally, this is two different curves. The curve in pink is the OPQC hospitals, and then the curve in blue are the non-OPQC hospitals. And it's looking at the Ohio births between 36 and 38 weeks that are elective, and showing that, again, that both are decreasing. The OPQC is actually decreasing a little bit faster, but we are having an effect statewide on the other hospitals that are not part of the collaborative.
So some of the things you might be asking are, well, you know, how are you collaborating and what are you doing as a state to make some of these achievements happen? Every month we have an action period call where we review this data in detail, and we have lots of discussion from teams. We give teams an opportunity to verify the data that they send to us so that we know that it's accurate. We have an incredible relationship with the Vital Statistics for Ohio, so we're able to really look at that data pretty closely and get it real time, within a month's time, which is excellent for us. We've done site visits to get a sense of what it looks like at the site for scheduled delivery to happen. You know, looking at the clerk who takes the call or the nurse manager who has to negotiate that that is not going to happen on that day because there's not enough evidence that it can. We've done one-on-one coaching as needed, although I think we prefer to try to use the collaborative as a group to coach each other. And then we use a listserv just as you do and some other communication methods just as you do. Some of the big key changes to make this improvement, Dave already had mentioned that we had a scheduled delivery policy. We were able to adopt early on a group from Ohio, the Mount Carmel system, who already had done a lot of work about a scheduled induction delivery policy that several of the teams have adopted. And every team uses the scheduled delivery consent form in some fashion, whether it's as they do at Miami Valley, use it as an option. The one thing that is great about that form is that all the teams access it in some way when they have to do a peer review for an induction they don't, they are not aware of. I'm sorry that they didn't support because it didn't have a medical indication. We did create consumer flyers for all of the teams to use, and we had several of them translated by age. So, for example, in the Columbus area where we have a high Appalachian population, we have it at the appropriate reading level for that population. They also have a high Somalian population there, so we translated that document for them in Somalian, or whatever that language is. I might not have said that appropriately. We have it in Spanish, as Dave already mentioned, and then a lot of teams used it in several different ways. They adapted the Intermountain Health form. They adapted the March of Dimes brain card form. We did a lot of testing around how to use those forms effectively, handing them out as a pamphlet, actually having a nurse talk to a patient, having a patient look at them and ask questions that could be addressed in the site visit. We did lots of work around how to make it an active pamphlet that would get people talking so that the consumer could be aware of their risks. 19 of our teams do have a formal peer review process in place. We all have lots of lively discussion on our monthly calls about what happens when we have those issues come up and a peer review has to be done. They're interesting to listen to, and I think the teams really appreciate commiserating with each other about some of the challenges there. We've looked at how to change scheduling the workflow. Is it right to have a secretary take the call versus a nurse manager take the call? Teams all do it differently, but they do share a lot about who is the best person to take the initial request for the scheduled delivery. And at a minimum, all the teams have adopted some procedural standard for scheduling induction. So whether it's a policy, a procedure, or a guideline, they all have something in writing that gives them some sense of what they should be doing to address this issue. So we've made an impact across the country, which is really exciting. I'll let Barb speak to some of those things.
Hi, it's Barb Rose. I'm the program director. Thanks very much for having us on the call. I'm going to be brief because I want to make sure that Dr. Kamath gets a chance to present her slides. Just to remind you guys, we Ohio did get a grant from CMS, Center for Medicaid, Medicare Services. We were awarded it in 07, and it came through about mid-08. So we were hugely lucky and successful in getting a pretty significant startup grant from federal Medicaid through Ohio Medicaid to really fund this work. It's one of the reasons that we've really had the opportunity to do two different clinical projects with OB and NEO, and also have the two projects working simultaneously. So we have results in both of our projects. Jay Imes, who is our clinical lead for the OB project, presented a platform presentation at the Society for MFM meeting in February with the results of our OB project. That platform presentation is also published in the March 2010 edition of JCOG, and then also his presentation won the research award at that setting. So we were really delighted to have collaborative work featured and also get some recognition among MFM peers. Both Dr. Imes and Dr. Donovan, who is our clinical lead on the NEO project, went to the National March of Dimes meeting in October and presented the preliminary work going on in Ohio. And then we also are connected pretty closely to the Ohio March of Dimes office. We have done a number of presentations and work closely with them, and they are also graciously sponsoring some of our spread work as we get ready to spread the lessons that we've learned in both projects across the state. The National March of Dimes QI office is actually helping with some of that funding. Next week at the Pediatric Academic Society in Vancouver, British Columbia, our Neonatology Improvement Advisor is going to be another platform presentation for results in OPQC. She's going to be talking about our NICU project, which is decreasing bloodstream late on bloodstream infections in 22 to 29 weekers. And then Dr. Donovan's got a poster about making the business case for quality on the NICU project. So I'd like to say a couple things quickly just about our partnerships in Ohio, particularly with Ohio Department of Health Vital Stats Office. They have been a terrific collaborator and have really worked with us to provide us monthly data for our birth certificate data run chart. Could not have done that without their really engagement and enthusiasm for this project. So I'm going to turn it back over to Ronnie, I think, so we can keep moving. Thanks very much.
Yep. Dr. McKenna probably only has a minute, so I'll just stop now if anybody wanted to ask him a particular question. Give him a minute to interact with you all.
We do have one question coming in from Women's Hospital in Greensboro. Have you worked on the operative services side for elective C-sections under 39 weeks? I was going to ask that question for you all. I know for some of our hospitals, that's in terms of putting policies, procedures, guidelines, whatever in place, that's been the area of greatest challenge.
If you stick your earplugs in from the iPhone into the back of your computer, it'll be a lot louder in your ears.
Dr. McKenna, have you done anything at Miami Valley specifically around operative services?
What we've done is we haven't split them out from inductions, and we consider a delivery, a scheduled delivery, a scheduled delivery, whether it's by cesarean or induction of labor. And in our hospital, it gets scheduled through the same person.
Maybe I should close the door.
I think that's probably what happens with most of our hospitals in OPQC regarding this particular issue. We had early on looked at should we push some opening of the operating room on Saturdays and Sundays, and that didn't meet with great enthusiasm. So it hasn't been an issue we've addressed really directly since then, just as Dr. McKenna is saying, we look at an induction as an induction.
Thanks. Yeah, and this is a great conversation that we won't completely delve into now because I don't want to lose Dr. Kamath's input. But this, many of our hospitals, especially our non-tertiary center participating hospitals, have separate OR scheduling teams, so the C-sections are scheduled in a different way than the inductions. We have started to hear from some places that have sort of a dual stop process. So there is an OR scheduler, but there has to be a clearance from L&D, and we're going to ask those sites to share a little bit more about how they've set that up, because it has turned out to be an ongoing challenge for those hospitals that have separate OR scheduling teams, where the priorities may just be different.
We would love to learn from you anything that you do as a state, and certainly we'll share back with you if this issue becomes something we address. I won't take much more time except to say that our future project for OB, as we continue the collaborative, will be looking at antenatal steroids, and we are just now in the process of developing the key driver and measures for that. We'll use a very similar methodology to introduce that topic and hope to launch it August or September, but do some preliminary work now. And then at the same time, our challenge will be to make sure that we sustain and hold our gains on this current project. So that's where we are in the OB project.
Thanks so much, Ronnie. And we're looking forward to continuing to learn from you as we are just gearing up to looking at how we're going to sustain our gains here in North Carolina as well. So hopefully we'll have some ongoing collaboration and keep learning from what's going on over there in Ohio. And Dr. Kamath, I think we have you on the line. I'll look if anyone wants to get a quick question in, and then hopefully we can have a few more minutes for questions. I know we're going to lose Dr. McKenna. All our obstetricians have to go deliver babies at this time of day, I realize. But otherwise, let's forge on ahead.
So thank you again for having us on the call. Like Kate said earlier, I'm a neonatologist, and I've had the honor of working with some of the other physician leaders in OPQC on this project, looking at birth certificate data at our biggest delivery hospital in the state of Ohio, which is Good Samaritan Hospital. We have about 7,000 deliveries per year there. And Dr. Albert earlier talked a little bit about, from the obstetrical side of things, how you date pregnancies, and this project is more about how that information is communicated towards other clinicians and also the birth certificate data to make sure that that data is of good quality so that as we continue to do this quality improvement work, we know that we are really making a difference. So I just wanted to show you here our team and really make the point that while we have some wonderful physician leaders on this project, really the people that are in the trenches doing a lot of the work and the tests of change are the nurses on the obstetrical service. So in antepartum, labor and delivery, and triage, they're really the ones that are down there working towards making our improvement happen. The interest in this project really happened from a couple sentinel events that we had at Good Samaritan Hospital where women came in and their dating from their obstetrical provider in the community was not appropriately communicated to the hospital, and the women's dating was obtained from what the women themselves gave the healthcare providers in the hospital, and their dating was incorrect. And so there were several cases where babies were born prematurely and ended up in the neonatal intensive care unit because that dating criteria had not been communicated correctly. So our goal with doing this project was really to make sure that that train of communication from the obstetrical providers to the hospital and to the neonatologist was intact. Ronnie has also already mentioned and had a slide about how now in Ohio we have a public website that hospitals are actually required to present their data in terms of some key outcome measures, some of which include infants less than 1,500 grams being born at the appropriate level of hospital, infants that are less than 32 weeks gestation receiving antenatal steroids. And a lot of these quality outcome measures that we're interested in are based on gestational age criteria. So this again hits the point home that understanding and communicating the accurate gestational age for our infant patients is of great importance, not just for clinical management of the patients, but also for research. So just to hit the point home further, we really use this gestational age information to make clinical decisions. We're asking research questions, and as you've seen, a lot of our OPQC data is based on birth certificate information. And then also, as we continue to want to improve our rates of prematurity here in Ohio, we want to make sure that we're targeting the infants that are most at risk. And we've heard from Dr. Navarro in particular how the late premature infants might be that growing population of infants that are premature that may need special attention. And so if our vital statistics are not complete or they're inaccurate, we're not really adequately able to know what is going on in the population that we're most interested in studying. And so I just wanted to give you just some other research, not to illustrate to you that this is not just a problem in Ohio, but nationwide, that it's well known that birth certificates, the quality of these can sometimes be in question. So this is an article from Jeff Gould at Stanford, who basically looked at infants who had incomplete birth certificates. And what he found is that those babies that had a greater number of unreported variables in their birth certificates were actually those infants that had the higher rates of neonatal mortality. And those are probably the infants that we're most interested in knowing something about as we want to improve rates of neonatal mortality. So when we're measuring gestational age, and I'm sure you all know this better than I do, that there are problems with the last menstrual period ultrasound and the clinical or postnatal maturational assessment of newborns. We know that each type of measuring gestational age, each method of measuring gestational age has its pros and cons. And so what ideally we want to do is have all of that information documented for us to understand how the gestational age was calculated. It's important to have all of those methods of estimating gestational age documented because depending on what method you use, you can have disparate results for things that you're interested in studying. So for example, if you're looking at post-term birth rates, if you're using ultrasound-generated gestational age versus LMP-estimated gestational age, you can see that the rates are quite different. So really having an understanding and documenting all of the methods and what gestational age was estimated based on those methods is important. So this slide is just to tell you that one of the most important things that we did in doing this project was actually following how the birth certificate is recorded in our hospital. And I would encourage you to do this because you will learn a lot of valuable information. And of course, how our birth certificates are done at Good Samaritan Hospital is going to differ from how it's done in Dr. McKenna's hospital and how it's done from your hospitals in North Carolina. But what we found was that there is an electronic medical record at Good Samaritan Hospital called OB TraceView, which you'll see here abbreviated as OBTV, and that is what the birth certificate recorder looked at to see whether or not to record what the gestational age was on her form that she then transmitted to the state and federal government. And oftentimes what we found is that the pregnancy tab in OB TraceView was incorrectly or just completely left blank. So what we realized is that OB TraceView was the source for multiple data repositories that were being used to do research and make clinical decisions, and that was really where we needed to focus to make sure that the nursing staff and the obstetrical providers had all of the information that they needed to fill out that pregnancy tab in OB TraceView so that the information could be correctly received in order to do the best research possible to make good clinical decisions and really target interventions for the populations that most needed it. So here's an example of what OB TraceView looks like, and you can see that in order for the pregnancy tab to be complete, there is a place for the last menstrual period to be documented, the ultrasound exam date, and the gestational age at which it was performed, and then there's a box that says based on where the nurse can put in what the obstetrical provider has used to base the estimation of gestational age, and then it actually calculates the estimated date of delivery for you. But oftentimes what the nurses were getting were these kind of ACOG forms from the community physician. So you can see that they put in, you know, there's an unsure LMP with this estimated date of delivery, or they would just write in a final date of delivery, and we really didn't understand upon which criteria that date of delivery was based. And so this really led to us doing a lot of education with not just the nursing staff, but also community physicians about how important it was that we get all of that information so that we could be very complete in recording this data in OB TraceView. So overall, our aim was to improve the reliability of gestational age recorded in the OB TraceView pregnancy tab, and it started out at a baseline of 25%, and we wanted to get it up to 75% by the end of January this year, and in the population of women who had prenatal care and were pregnant with an infant at least 20 weeks gestation, because those are the women that would have a birth certificate recorded for their infant. And so you can see by our run chart here, and what you can see on the x-axis are the dates, and our data is collected daily. And it does get a little bit tight with all the information on there, but we've also recorded the number of deliveries that we have per day. And then on the y-axis, what you can see is the percentage of those daily deliveries that had the pregnancy tab completed correctly. And as I said, we started out at about 25%, and with the hard work of the nursing staff and working on different tests of change to better communicate the ACOG forms to the hospital, we've been able to improve our results up to about 75% now. Overall, what we've learned is that the birth certificate process is very complex, and again, I would encourage you to follow how that process works at your hospital. It's also been wonderful to really work with the nurses and, you know, see how they do their education, because really just with the nursing education that was done, we were really able to double our completion of the pregnancy tabs. It's always difficult in terms of dealing with attitudes about change, and in particular working with each of the community practices, because each of them has a different process for how they're communicating their ACOG forms to the hospital. So that is a challenge in and of itself to learn all of those different processes as well. But I'm happy to take any questions, and thank you again for having us on the call.
Thanks so much, Dr. Kamath. I picture a room full of nurse champions in the 39 Weeks Project nodding their heads, because I think you've really hit the nail on the head for a lot of the challenges that come up frequently when we're discussing gestational age criteria for this project. There's a question from Women's Hospital. Maybe you can just clarify this, and this is actually a point I want to make about the North Carolina birth certificate. But the question from here in North Carolina is, have the nurses always completed birth certificates?
So the nurses are not the ones that are completing the birth certificates. What the nurses are doing is entering the data into that electronic obstetrical medical record, OB TraceView, and from that is where the birth certificate recorder gets the information. So if that pregnancy tab is not completed, we're really relying on the birth certificate recorder, who is oftentimes not a medically trained person, to then go through the chart and try to piece together herself what the obstetrician meant with the gestational age. So the RNs are not the ones completing the birth certificate. They're just documenting the information in the chart from which the birth certificate recorder abstracts that information.
Thanks for clarifying that. And I think that's just so important. I think for those nurses who've been doing the data collection for this project, they are well aware of what a challenge it can be to try to piece together what the obstetrician meant when they're sitting with the chart, and then to think of somebody who doesn't have any type of clinical background facing that challenge. I know in Ohio you all have used the new birth certificate for a few years now. We are just now starting to roll it out here in North Carolina, but it is actually happening as we speak. It was supposed to happen last year. Because of the budget crisis, it got pushed back until this year. This is going to be piloted, I believe, next month and the month after in a couple of our counties. And by the end of the year, all of us will be using the new birth certificate. So for the North Carolina teams that are on the call, one thing I would just encourage everyone to do is to make sure that you know who the birth registrar is at your facility if you don't already, because Dr. Kamath's point about the need for good data on our birth certificates can't be understated. And if we don't have a good relationship with our people who are turning in our vital stats, that data won't do us any good. And so much is driven by that data. Similarly, I was going to bring up a similar issue, the accuracy of coding data, which is going to be relevant with the new Joint Commission perinatal care measures, much of which are driven by coding data. Our own Dr. Cheshire, who's our clinical lead for this project, has a study published about inaccuracy in the coding data. So obviously, for all of us who are going to have any practice changes driven by this kind of data, you know, good data has to go in to get good data out. And I think this presentation really drives that point home, as well as just the challenge that I know we've discussed over the past several months of finding, of just really understanding what criteria were used to establish gestational age, and how to communicate that to the labor and delivery who's going to deliver the patient. I know we're about out of time. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, this is Ronnie. Just to piggyback on what you're saying there, some things we've learned in OPQC, when we've been stuck and haven't seen tremendous movement toward our aim, or when we've seen that our OPQC hand-collected data was performing significantly better than the birth certificate data, we've done really targeted testing, doing exactly what you're saying, having the OPQC team really work with the vital statistic or the birth certificate completion person at their hospital. And it almost always is a coding or misinterpretation issue. I would say 99% of the time it's that the OPQC person either knew where to find the data and the person completing the birth certificate did not know where to find it, or they misinterpreted the diagnosis, or they didn't think that the diagnosis was actually verified in the chart in some way. And right now what we're doing is a group PDSA where we've asked OPQC teams to go and complete three birth certificate data independently from their birth certificate completion person so that we can maybe have our teams learn about the arduous process that might be happening at their hospital to try to make improvements there.
Great, thanks. And our just so our labor and delivery folks are aware, all of the birth registrars in North Carolina are undergoing training on the new birth certificate over the next couple of months. So this is a good time to check in with them and just find out what they've learned about the new birth certificate. The new birth certificate has a vast amount of data compared to what we've been able to access before. But again, as this presentation emphasizes, if the data that is collected isn't valid, then we can't do much with it. We do have a question, Dr. Hudspeth, in the western part of the state wanted to ask, many hospitals are using OB TraceView. Do you feel like there are any places to improve the system, or is it good as it is?
Well, being a neonatologist, I feel like I'm not an expert to talk about OB TraceView. I mean, there are many parts of that system that I don't necessarily use because I'm mainly looking at certain aspects of the data that will affect my ability to take care of the baby patient. So I don't think I'm an expert to say that. But what I will say is that, you know, OB TraceView is designed to do certain things, and this is just an example of how the system might be really great, but if it's not used properly and the data inputted into it correctly, it's not living up to its full potential.
Thanks. And I think it speaks to the importance when we're working as a collaborative about the issue of standardization and getting the variability out of the system. And even within one hospital, that can be a challenge just to get everybody to agree to do something the same way, like you said, when there are multiple community practices at the same hospital, and then to think about doing that as a state. But hopefully the more of us that are thinking about how to do something in a more standardized, consistent manner, hopefully we can bring some attention to that. I'm going to just put a last call out for questions because we're a couple minutes over time, and I know everybody's got a busy day coming up, and I really appreciate the time the Ohio folks have given us. I also wanted to just acknowledge the other clinical lead from OPQC is Ed Donovan. He's their neonatology lead. He's sort of the Marty McCaffrey of Ohio, and he joined us this morning. I saw logged in, so just thanks for being with us, Dr. Donovan. He speaks about the work that Ohio is doing nationally quite a bit, so we're glad to have him supporting our work here in North Carolina as well. I want to thank everyone for being with us this morning. I think hopefully we will start to have some more interstate collaboration. It's really been great to hear more about what has happened in Ohio around the 39 Weeks Project and to see the good work and hear some of the strategies that have worked. Again, we have the advantage here in North Carolina that Ohio is several months ahead of us, so we get to learn from some of the challenges they face. But hopefully as time goes forward and we're all working on how we can spread this around our states to hospitals that haven't worked with our collaboratives yet, how we can make sure we're sustaining the progress that we have achieved so far. Hopefully those are areas where we can all really collaborate together. We've got some great folks in both North Carolina and Ohio working together on this, and I look forward to all of us being able to focus in the future. Again, I will say the Ohio crew has made themselves very available to us on email. So if people have questions, I know that Ronnie and her team are very generous about following up. So please do send questions to us, and we will get questions answered. I will make sure for 39 Weeks teams that we share some of the Ohio materials by attached to our weekly email. Some of them are on our extranet right now. And I will just mention a question came in. This call is recorded, so we will post this on the PCNIC website along with all of the presentations, which are posted there now. If you look under conferences, look for today's date in 39 weeks, and all of these presentations are posted. Again, thank you so much to everyone in Ohio for joining us this morning. That was a pleasure to hear from you.